This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark here once again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and of course, some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Now, if you have a question for Zorba, this is a great time to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And of course, along with your calls, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about email for seniors. What does it mean socially if seniors don't connect on the internet? And what does it mean socially if they do connect on the internet?
And
we're going to talk about the recent raw milk ruling. The controversy concerning raw milk, is it good for you or not? And more importantly, can you get it? What are the national ramifications
of
it?
I know this is one you've talked about before. We'll address that issue again. And what's our recipe?
Eggplant fresh. I love eggplant.
And I, well, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's welcome our first caller now, a listener in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi.
Howdy, guys.
How can we help you?
Well, I have a strange, I guess you could say, protrusion on my left knee, right at the top of the tibia there, and it's, I don't know, kind of a calcium deposit or something or another, and it's rather painful when I'm, like if I'm doing yoga and I have to do something where I'm flat on my knee and my shin's in contact with the ground, or on the off chance that I bang it into something, it'll take me straight to the ground. It is extremely painful sometimes. Yeah.
Well, I could suggest stop doing yoga, but Zorba wouldn't like
that. I don't think that that's really...
How long have you had this thing?
I guess I noticed it around high school sometime.
Oh, so quite a while.
Yeah.
Now, when you were younger, when you were first in high school and, you know, you're going through puberty, usually there's an area of what we call the tibia, which is connected to the tendon that fits with the kneecap. We've got our kneecap and it slides back and forth. And one connection is in the upper part of the leg and the other connection is the lower part of the leg, the tibia. And there's something called Osgood-Schlatter's disease, which is not really a disease, but it's that tibia tubercle, it's called, that little protrusion. And for some people, that growth plate on that protrusion can be very, very painful. So did you have pain when you were in high school?
Not much.
But
it showed up more during rugby impacts and soccer slides, but that was about
rugby impacts. Rugby impacts. Now that, talk about a painful
rugby, soccer, yoga.
That's right, yoga. Well, of the impact, I think yoga is probably the lowest impact. Of course, your body's gotten a little bit older than when you used to play rugby, I assume.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little bit, exactly. So does this bother you when you're not on your knee?
Not particularly. It gets a little sore when I'm running, but I'm usually really good about the shoes and the insoles that I get, and it's not a big deal. If I go distances over about 5 or 6 miles, it can get really sore when I'm done running.
Right, and this is what happens is that's because as you bring your leg forward, you actually have the ligaments from the patella, from the kneecap, that are attached to this area called the tibial tubercle. And basically the answer is ice it when it bothers you, wear pads on your knees so you don't put any direct pressure on it. That's the treatment for it. And if it bothers you enough, then you take an anti-inflammatory. So, for instance, if you took two Aleve, generic Aleve, before you ran, an hour before you ran, you might not have that pain. And there's not much that we do about it. We don't do surgery. The surgery doesn't really do anything for it. And it's just the way your body grew. That particular part of the bone is, I don't think I would call it weaker because it really isn't weaker. It just is chronic inflammation from this thing that you had as a teenager called Osgood-Schlatter's disease. And by the way, very good example of dumb, stupid medicine is how Osgood-Schlatter's disease used to be treated. They used to say, oh, you've got it. It's a disease. You could see it on X-ray. And they used to put these kids in these long leg casts from their thigh to their feet them on crutches for 6 months because they felt that that if they didn't do that, that this little area, which essentially is connected to the bone, would come off. And they did this through the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And finally, in the 60s, somebody said, let's let's do a study and put half the kids in casts and half the kids out of casts, and there was no difference.
Well, I'm glad they did the study.
Oh, they did the study. It was just amazing. Nobody ever did the study. They said, you've got to cast it. You've got this. Otherwise, and nobody bothered to check to see if it works. So now, basically, we treat it with anti-inflammatories. I mean, medicine sometimes is dumb and stupid, and that was just a good example. I thought I'd throw that in. Yeah. But that was back in the 60s. We don't do anything wrong now.
Well, thank you so much. That's been really helpful.
A pleasure.
And keep on running and yoga and soccer and rugby.
Absolutely. And, yeah. Absolutely. You got to keep on moving that body. And if your joints are a little painful as you get older, well, then you treat the pain. No pain, no gain.
Well, let's talk now, Zorba, about email. And older people.
And older people, that's right. Email, older people, and computers. Mm-hmm. You know, what has happened is a number of studies have shown that older adults are becoming more and more isolated from younger people because they don't engage in computer language skills. I mean, I'm going to give it a big
Computer language skills.
I'm going to give it a highfalutin name. This is a big problem for people as they get older.
And here is what, a new program that's specifically designed to help older people because it's so easy to use the email?
Well, it's one of several new programs. The real answer is not just the program. The real answer is to go and get educated on the interface if you don't use it. And the way to do that is often through your local library. Your local library, your local senior center, your local junior college, your local college, they all have computer literacy skills. They're often taught, they're often introduction to email. They're often introduction to Windows, introduction to the Mac. And what you need is you need to have very minimal skills to know what you're looking at. Another perfect example is a book. Imagine that you're literate, mm-hmm. but you've never looked at a book on how to do something, we'll say a cookbook. And so you don't realize that a cookbook has a certain format to it. There are the ingredients, there's the recipe, there's how you put it together. There's what it tastes like. We're all literate with cookbooks. I mean, anyone who's literate has looked at a cookbook. You may not cook,
right. But
there's a format to it. It's the same with a computer. It's that there are two groups of people in this country, the computer natives and the computer immigrants. If you're 30 years and younger, you're a native.
Sure.
And if you're 30 years and older, you're an immigrant.
Yeah.
And so you're not as comfortable with the language. But I'll give you another example. I talked to my kids. I have four wonderful kids. My youngest is 22. And I thought, you know, I'm going to join Twitter. I'm going to tweet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about Twitter. And my daughter, who's 22, said, oh, I don't tweet. I don't know anything about it. And I thought, you don't tweet. That means if I talk to somebody who was 18, they would know right away about Twitter and tweet. Here it is. It's another format. I said, can you help me get started on this? She said, oh, sure, Dad. I'll tweet and you'll tweet and we'll get together on it. There was no comment. Then I talked to my wife, Penny, and I said, I'm going to tweet. I'm going to join Twitter. And she said, what's Twitter?
Yeah.
Well, she didn't know what Twitter was. I said, it's like Facebook. She said, well, I don't know anything about Facebook. She's not even on Facebook. She doesn't even do YouTube. Duh. Well, these are all these things. So it's important if you don't go to a computer and you don't connect to computers to get a little bit of education on it because it really opens up your world.
Well, here's how old I am. I remember when people used to write letters to each other.
Oh, gosh. That is so old tech, Tom. It is so old tech.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413.
I want to comment, though, about that. That's really important. I was just with the Dalai Lama's doctor, and we were going around the U.S. doing a few things. And we saw some very nice people who talked to him. And I said, you should write thank you notes. And he said, you mean send them an email? I said, no. The highest form of flattery in our society is a handwritten thank you note. So writing those letters in a handwritten style is truly a high form of flattery.
That is right. Caller with us now, Zorba, in Middleton, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I was just at my annual checkup a week and a half ago, and the doctor, my new intern, suggested that I have a bone density test. And I went, well, what's that? And she said, she asked if I'd ever had one because I just turned 60. And I said no. And I was just wondering what that's all about.
A bone density test looks at whether or not you have osteoporosis or osteopenia. Now, osteopenia is osteoporosis light. In other words, it doesn't mean you have osteoporosis, but you're headed in that direction, and you don't meet the criteria. The criteria of whether or not you have it is determined by the density of your bones as measured by this machine that measures density. Yeah. It's very clear, and it's a criteria. Now, why is it important? Well, if you have osteoporosis, you're at risk for fractures. Why is that important? Well, nobody wants a hip fracture. If you have a hip fracture and you're over the age of 65, there is a 50% chance you will be disabled forever in one or more of an activity of daily living, and a 20% chance that you'll be dead in 2 years from those complications. So the goal is to reduce the risk of hip fractures. Well, how do we do that? Well, people of osteopenia, osteoporosis light, or of osteoporosis can be put on medications. Now, these medicines, although they're not great, increase the bone density by 2 to 3%, and that's enough to dramatically reduce the risk of fracture. And then we do other things, exercise, calcium, weight-bearing exercise, balance, and this will help guide prevention.
Yeah, I have osteopenia,
right?
But I was told they couldn't tell from just one test whether this was a part of a progression along the line toward osteoporosis or whether I've had the same sort of bone density all my life, because there's no, you know, there's no line of testing that's gone on.
Right. So sometimes we'll repeat it in a year or 2 years or 5 years.
But what
is
they,
it hereditary?
Yes, it is. It is. That is her, did your mom have it?
My mother does not have it.
Has she had her bone density checked?
Yes, she has.
Mm-hmm. So she doesn't have it.
No.
That doesn't mean you don't have it.
No.
It just means
I
you don't have the genetic predisposition.
So what do? You go, you get a, is it an X-ray?
It's a densitometry. It's like, it uses radiation like an X-ray, but it is not an X-ray.
Yeah. I was told vitamin D is good.
Vitamin D is good. Vitamin D supplement.
Yeah, I take calcium with D, but like you said, it's, you still can have it. So it's very interesting.
Very interesting. Very important to get tested. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you so much.
We appreciate the call. Thank you. 800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba in West Lafayette, Indiana. Hello.
Hi.
How can we help?
I am 6 months pregnant with our first child. And we have a small vegetable garden, and we are very fond of earth. So we have a vegetable garden which is kind of devoted to earth. And like we have like basil, oregano, dill, fennel, etc. So I was wondering, are there specific herbs that I should stay away from now and later on when I'm lactating? So, and are there beneficial herbs that I could take now and later?
Very good points. You know, when you're pregnant, the issue is there anything safe or anything unsafe? And that's, I think that's a good point. This is your first baby, second baby?
Oh, my first baby.
Your first baby. How nice. When's your baby? So it's your first baby. So when we look at things that are safe, things that are not safe, first of all, we know are alcohol. We know that's not safe. So you don't, I assume that you don't take any alcohol at all.
None at all.
Right. And the answer with alcohol is very interesting. It's really that first trimester. It's really significant amounts of alcohol. But because we don't know what a significant amount really is, by definition, we say no alcohol at all. That's the best way to do it. And of course, no tobacco. So we want to stay away from those toxins. You want to stay away from cats because cats have toxoplasmosis. And the only reason I mention it is sometimes people have cats around their garden and they're playing with cats. You don't change the litter box when you're pregnant. So do you have any cats around the house?
No.
Okay. So those are the big things that we look for. Anything that that will give you the desire to have more fruits and vegetables will be good for you and the baby. So in other words, spices that you grow in the garden, like you say, fennel and basil and rosemary, that make food more tasty and keep you away from eating too much salt, are basically things that are healthy for you. Americans eat too much salt, and often when women are pregnant, they want to have much more salt. And the goal with salt is to keep it between 2 and 3 grams a day. And spices are the way to do it. So actually, you're growing spices and using it in your food make it much more likely that you're going to use less salt. All the spices are safe. There's nothing that's unsafe at all. And somehow getting out in that garden, working in the garden, thinking about the baby, I think that just sounds so great. It sounds like, you know, it will make that pregnancy just seem all the better.
But I have like so little time. I'm slated to graduate with my PhD end of this year, so that's almost like I take away a little of my time. It's nice. It's my like leisure hours in the garden.
No. So let me get this straight. So you're completing a PhD and you're pregnant and you have a garden. When do you have time to rest in between?
Gardening is my time to rest. I love outdoors.
It is very good. And you bring up a good point, because when you're finishing your PhD, it's really an indoor project that you're doing. So getting outside and playing in the dirt is something that is excellent to do. So, well, good luck to you and good luck on your pregnancy.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I know something useful now, so appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad we could help.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Speaking of pregnancy, Zorba, it's time for another edition of Stump the Doc. With a question from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox, today's contestant is Christy. Christy writes, I wanted to take you up on your Stump the Doctor offer. I'm thinking I might be successful, as every medical person I've spoken to about my situation has responded with a puzzled side, huh? I'm allergic to tomatoes. Because I have learned how to live with the hives, I choose what foods I'm willing to eat, knowing what the consequences are. So, what am I stumping you about, you ask? Well, while I am pregnant, and for the first many months of my nursing my children, I get no hives. Oh, and you better believe I eat all the tomato products I can get my hands on while I'm pregnant and nursing. Is there a reason why I don't get hives when I'm pregnant or nursing?
Well, I mean, the answer is clear. You have to be pregnant all the time so you can eat all the tomatoes you want to eat. I mean, that's the obvious answer.
That's it.
5, 10, 15, 20 babies, and then you can have tomatoes. You can have tomatoes all the time.
Why does this happen?
Well, there are hormonal changes that occur during pregnancy. There are changes in cortisol levels. There are changes in how your body reacts to various things. And clearly what's happening is you have more anti-inflammatory molecules running by, and you don't have what's called the IgE response, which is often a response that occurs when you're consuming food that you're allergic to. And so it's those hormonal changes. What hormones there are, I don't know. But clearly, these are the hormonal changes that occur during pregnancy. And frankly, that's okay. That means it's one of the benefits, the bonuses of being pregnant.
If you think you can stump Public Radio's favorite family doc, send your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your questions coming up. We have our medical mythbuster later in the hour. Some more research, of course, too. All here after the recipe on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time now, and then we're back to the phones at 1-800-462-7413. But for our recipe, Eggplant Fresh, we welcome now St. Louis, Missouri listener Elizabeth Perry. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Now, most people would say Eggplant Elizabeth or Eggplant Perry. Why Eggplant Fresh for this recipe?
I named this dish after the person who taught it to me. She was a student of mine about 40 years ago at the University of Colorado. She came from Iran, and she was determined to make me like eggplant, and she succeeded.
So until this recipe, you didn't like eggplant.
Correct. I thought it was kind of a disgusting vegetable, yeah. Actually.
Well, that's kind of what I think eggplant is, so maybe
right.
This will turn me around on eggplant.
Well, I hope so.
So we're going to convert Tom from the tofu, non-tofu eater to the pro-eggplant eater. That's
okay.
With this particular dish. So we start out with one large eggplant or two small eggplants. These are regular eggplants, not the Japanese small eggplants.
Correct. I usually look for a good firm purple eggplant. But in the summer, when fresh eggplants are at the farmers' markets, I get the white eggplants or the striped eggplants. And they are very non-bitter and very fresh, of course.
Oh, really? You know, yes. I didn't know that. I've seen the white and the striped over the summer, but I don't think I've ever purchased one. So there's a difference in the taste in the white and striped?
Not too much difference, but they just are less bitter, and that you can eat the skins, although I tend pretty much to peel them anyway. But the key, if you're not sure about how fresh they are, the best thing to do is to peel it, slice it across crosswise, really, and have your slices, put them in a colander and salt them on both sides and let them drain, and the bitter juices drain out of them. This is a trick that almost every good cook knows, but
right,
I didn't
right.
know it 40 years ago right. when Faresh showed me that.
Right.
So
I do know that now. Use kosher salt or regular salt?
I use regular salt.
So just regular salt works.
Right.
I'm going to have to try, when I can get a hold of white or striped eggplant, I'm going to have to try that. And frankly, I've never paid attention to blemishes in the eggplant when I peel it. I just, sometimes they have had blemishes, and I've never noticed that those are the recipes that I failed with.
Mm.
But I bet you they have. And it's because I don't think we have enough experience often in this country of working with eggplants. So we don't know what a fresh eggplant looks like. I'm going to pay more attention. Okay, let's go on. Mm-hmm. 1 to 2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil or olive oil cooking spray. Now, I've got a wonderful container that I got as a gift from Tom's wife years ago. I'm sure Tom will remember this. Monica gave me a gift of using olive oil, and I can pour it into a container, and it makes the olive oil into a spray. I know Tom remembers that gift.
I never knew anything about
never knew. It's
gift.
A wonderful, it's a way to make your own olive oil cooking spray. It's a wonderful little gadget. You pour it in and then you make it into a pump. There's a way that you pump it up. Have you ever seen one of those things?
We're on our third generation of those sprays. They tend to clog up.
They do. How do you get the clog out?
Well, you take the whole thing apart and you soak it in dishwater, dish detergent, and try to clean it out. But it's never... They never work as well as when you first buy them at the store.
That is a great idea. You know what? You've just helped me picking eggplants and getting rid of the clog on the
darn
olive oil
thing.
But
the other thing, I think Alton Brown on his cooking show says just buy a regular little sprayer. You know, a water bottle sprayer and put your oil in that, and that would work just as well.
Frankly,
I haven't tried that yet.
Frankly, and you can buy those for $1 a piece.
That's right.
Much
and that's
cheaper.
All the time we have for our recipe this week.
Hey,
so if you want the recipe, go to our website.
Wait a second. Yeah. I want advice too. That's how you learn. This is radio, radio.
It's an hour long show,
guys. We learn about advice. All right, okay.
All half right, lemon. Enough. Let's get back to the recipe.
Let's get back. Okay. I'll stay on task. Fantastic.
Okay,
1/2 lemon juiced and zested. So you got to tell me how you do that.
Well, you zest it first. That's important, to zest it before you cut the lemon in half and then juice it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Because
so
otherwise,
it'll be hard to get the
zest off
right,
if
sure.
you've already juiced
right,
the
right,
lemon.
Right. That's right. The way it is. One small can of tomato juice.
Right.
Okay. 1/4 cup of diced green peppers or red peppers or some combination. Green is cheaper than red.
Right.
1/4 cup of dry white wine.
Or more. All of these amounts are very approximate.
Fungible. We can move them around.
Very fungible, right.
2 fresh tomatoes diced or a small can of diced tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, I always use the diced ones because the fresh ones are not fresh. They look like tomatoes and they taste like cardboard.
Or plastic.
1/2 teaspoon of dried basil or parsley. Do you use fresh?
I do, and if it's in season, of course, I put in a lot of fresh basil and parsley.
Right, and that's wonderful. And parsley is always available, and the fresh is best.
Right.
1/4 teaspoon of cinnamon, mm-hmm. 1 teaspoon of sugar,
mm-hmm.
and a pinch of saffron.
And that's optional. If you don't have the saffron, don't worry about it.
Where do you buy your saffron? I got to get this in. I'm not going to tell her where I buy my saffron. Where do you buy your saffron?
We have a wonderful international store in St. Louis where we get most of our supplies. So
that's exactly right, and that's where saffron is cheap. So let's do the recipe.
No. I have a question.
Go ahead.
I don't notice any meat in this recipe.
Well, actually, when Paresh first made me this dish, he made it with little lamb meatballs, and I do that too, ground lamb meatballs. Or you can use beef as well, or you can use any kind of leftover. Oh, if you have some baked chicken or broiled chicken, cut it up and put that in. You can use almost any meat in it that you want, but it is very good meatless.
Thomas Smiley.
I'm glad I asked the question.
Thomas Smiley. So let's make the recipe. Peel the eggplant, slice it into 1/2-inch slices, and then heat the olive oil in a nonstick pan over medium heat. We use a nonstick pan because we can use less oil. Saute the eggplant slices until brown on both sides. Then add lemon juice, the rind, tomato juice, and enough water to keep everything from sticking, enough to keep it from sticking. And then lower the heat into a simmer. Mm-hmm. Add the remaining ingredients, simmer for 10 minutes. Break up the eggplant into nice thick chunks and give the mixture a good stir. Add more water to the sauce if it gets a little bit dry. Mm-hmm. Serve it over rice or couscous or orzo and enjoy.
Exactly. And one thing I didn't put in the recipe that I forgot was that when Faresh made her rice, she put, maybe quarter of a teaspoon to half a teaspoon of turmeric, ground turmeric, in the rice, and that turned it yellow. And serving it over yellow rice is very pretty.
Sounds delicious. I will serve it.
It doesn't change the taste too much.
I shall serve it at my next event. We'd love to entertain at our house. This is going to be a dynamite thing. Thank you.
I hope you enjoy it. We certainly do.
Thanks a lot, Elizabeth.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye-bye. And for sending us this winning recipe, Elizabeth gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's really easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
is our toll-free number. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Boise, Idaho. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, you know, I'm turning 25, and I thought I would get in the habit of getting regular annual physical checkups. And I'm just wondering what kind of blood tests or tests I should ask the doctor for that would get me the best bang for my buck in one visit.
This is a great question. What is a physical checkup? What should it be?
Right. And the best for your buck at every visit. So the first thing, you know, from your age point of view, was when was the last time you had a Pap test?
2 years ago?
Well, that's the most important thing. The Pap test is extremely important for a woman at your age because cervical cancer, cervical dysplasia, which is precancer, is the most common form of cancer in young people. Worldwide, it is a major cause of cancer death, not in this country because we often have the availability of Pap tests. But that's the number one, beyond a shadow of a doubt, thing that you should be checked every year. High blood pressure. Do you have it in your family at all?
We actually have low blood pressure in my family.
Low blood pressure is good. High blood pressure is bad, so you want to have your blood pressure checked. That's cheap. That's easy. That's inexpensive. They'll do it when you go into the doctor's office with that. Now, if you have a family history of cholesterol problems or early heart attacks, you know, as a woman, it's less likely, but they can have it. If somebody has had a heart attack before the age of 50 as a man, 50 or 55, before the age of 55 as a woman, then you want to have your cholesterol checked probably one time in your 20s and 30s. That's probably the minimum that you want to have. You don't really have to be checked for anemia unless something is going on. You really don't have to be checked for kidney disease with a urine test. You can save your money. The big issue really would be a pap test. And then you want to look at the other health issues. Are you eating right? Are you exercising right? What's your height? What's your weight?
Oh, I am 5'4"-ish. And 133.
So, you know, it's making sure that you do that. You know, staying. I mean, that's definitely a good weight. And do you exercise?
I'm getting better about it.
Getting better about it is really the thing. Eating fruits and vegetables, a more Mediterranean diet. That's the other stuff you go over in the office. Wearing seatbelts. Do you wear seatbelts 100% of the time you're in your car?
101%.
Absolutely. That's the main issue. And are you in a smoking environment or do you smoke cigarettes?
I do not smoke at all.
Okay, and that's exactly it. You want to stay away from that. You don't want to have more than 2 drinks a day. You can have 7 to 14 drinks a week, not on Saturday night. And those are kind of that basically is what I would do. I think the pap test is the thing you need, and chlamydia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When are you turning 25?
Today.
Oh! Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to caller in Boise, Idaho.
Happy birthday to you.
Now, I have a quick question for you. Does 5'4"-ish mean you're 5'3.5"?
It's between 5'3.5 and 5'4.5.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. You weren't cheating by hedging up a little bit.
No, oh, okay. I told you my exact weight.
Well, have a great day, and thanks a lot for the call.
And treat yourself to good health on your birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah, make an appointment.
Great, will do.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
800-462-7413. It's toll-free. 1-800-462-7413. To a Norman, Oklahoma caller now. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good. How can we help you?
Okay, well, let's see. About 4 years ago, I started running normally, and I had what I thought were shin splints. And they haven't gone away, and I did some research online after a run one day when I was in serious pain like I usually am, and I came across what was chronic compartment syndrome, and I'm afraid that might be what I have. I went to a couple doctors, and they told me I might need to get a test done, but unfortunately, I'm going to lose my insurance soon because I'm graduating. And I won't be in school anymore. So what I'm wondering is how important it is for me to get this test done, if there's anything I can do to kind of control the pain while I'm waiting, or if it's really necessary. Because while I was looking, it said that if you wait too long, it can cause serious nerve damage, and I definitely don't want that.
Yeah. What did she say she thought?
Compartment syndrome.
Compartment syndrome.
And in the lower leg, we have muscles that are constrained by tendons. And if the muscles swell too much, then they compress the blood supply, and you can have damage from that. Uh-huh. And in acute injuries, I've got a good friend, his son, who is now a doctor, when he was a young man, had a soccer injury, a terrible soccer injury, and had severe compartment syndrome. And the treatment, when you have severe compartment syndrome of a traumatic nature, is you literally make a slice in the lower leg and you allow the muscles to sort of go out and keep from compressing the compartment. It's not what she had. That's serious compartment syndrome. The test, by the way, is they put a needle in there and they look at the pressure in the compartment. But I want to talk to you a little bit about insurance before we go on. Are you on the health insurance at school or on your parents' health insurance?
I was on my stepdad's and he got a substantial discount while I was in school.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now that I'm not, won't be enrolled as a full-time student anymore, he won't get that discount, and I'm pretty sure it's going
to
go away.
Well, you have to check on that. I'll tell you why. In certain states, it's a state-run thing. Your insurance runs until the end of the calendar year, even though you may be finishing your academic year. So it's very important from an insurance point of view that you call up and you find out. And I mention that because your insurance may actually run to the end of the calendar year, and that means you've got some time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not you really need to have something done is a good question. They can't answer without a needle that's in there, but the fact is sometimes they actually go in and do a significant surgical procedure. Very unusual.
Right.
Not very common. Usually the answer is to try to figure out what to do from a sports medical point of view. Mm-hmm. And the treatment often means doing some stretching and other exercises beforehand and not traumatizing that lower leg as much. So the needle may give you an answer, but you're not going to have surgery if you can do it without surgery.
Right,
I'd look at stretching techniques. I'd go to the web and Google shin splints. You'll see a number of good things. Go to YouTube and go to shin splints, and you'll get dynamic descriptions of techniques that you can use to basically stretch those ligaments out. And I love YouTube for this, because often you'll get physical therapists from all over the country are now putting their explanations on YouTube, and it's better than the static pictures you get from a book, frankly.
Yeah.
Those links, by the way, are on our website.
And those links are on our website, which is zorbapastor.org. So we'll have those links. Come to our website and look at those links. They're very important. And that's what I would do. I wouldn't go through the needle thing, but find out if your insurance continues, because if not, you've got to have a high deductible policy to protect you in case of an emergency. And this is a big issue, especially with young people in our society today. They don't have a high deductible policy if they end up in the hospital with something. And those policies are often $50 a month. They're inexpensive, relatively inexpensive. So good luck. I had to give some insurance advice along with some medical advice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for calling us. Let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox, Zorba, and see if we can help out Mary from Buffalo, New York, who has a question on cheese. She writes, over one weekend, I had a mild UTI.
Urinary tract infection. Uh-huh. You know, UTIs and URIs are an upper respiratory infection.
Okay, thanks. And knew I would have to call my doctor on Monday. However, I also ate a lot of very moldy, very yummy gorgonzola cheese. By Monday morning, all the symptoms of the UTI had gone. That night, I was watching the Food Network, and they were talking about blue cheeses and mentioned that the mold is a penicillium mold. I was curious to know if the mold in the cheese I was eating over the weekend could have acted like an antibiotic and resolved the UTI.
That's a good question. The answer is maybe it did. Penicillin came from one type of penicillium mold, and maybe that did it. That's a possibility. Also, UTIs go away. They aren't all treated. Sometimes you push the fluids, you get the urine going and flushed, and the UTI may have just gone away on its own. And you had the symptoms of UTI, but we don't know if you really had one because you didn't actually have a urine test. So you might have had the symptoms, a little irritation there, and maybe it worked. Maybe it's not just cranberry juice, but it's gorgonzola cheese. Maybe with some crackers and a little glass of red wine. Hey, that's the treatment for UTI.
Now,
I love it.
Some trivia here, Zorba. You know a whole lot. You know almost everything. Did you know that the London Stock Exchange is called the Gorgonzola Hall due to its green marble interior?
I never knew that.
I never knew it either.
Thanks to
Adam Friedrich, who maybe knows more everything than Zorba knows.
Mr. Trivia, we call him.
If you have a lifestyle question, we want to hear it. Send it in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research coming up. We have our medical myth buster as well. Oh, and more of your calls, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, an interesting, I think important topic to talk about, and that's raw milk.
That's right. Raw milk, always a controversial issue, big controversial issue, certainly in the state of Wisconsin and nationwide, whether or not you should be able to sell it or not. There are people on one side of the issue who say, wait a minute, raw milk has constituents, enzymes that are good for us, healthier for us. On the other side, you have the state medical society, and people say, wait a minute, you're going to spread disease. This is going to be a huge problem.
Now, you mentioned Wisconsin. We're working here in Wisconsin through legislation dealing with this. Talk a bit about how this legislation would work.
Well, we're looking at legislation in Wisconsin that will allow raw milk to be actually sold farmer to individual. Farmers won't be able to sell it to a store. You'll be able to track which farm it comes from. The farmers will have to have the cows tested once a month to make sure that they don't have pathogen in them. And the idea is that this is actually going on in this state and in any state where this is dairy. This is actually going on. So maybe we should regulate it and keep the public safe.
So the way that this would work is if I want to buy raw milk, I would go to a farmer and buy it, but I wouldn't be able to get it in a store.
Oh, absolutely not. And the concept is that you're actually able to go out to the country to the farmer, get it, and then we can actually track if you get ill that you bought it from this particular farm. So one of the issues is if you start to sell raw milk on a more commercial basis, you may taint the milk supply in that we won't know which farmer or perhaps which cow this comes from. So the dairy industry on one side is worried that all of a sudden people are going to stop drinking milk because they're going to get sick. And on the other hand, you have advocates for raw milk who say, wait a minute, I should be able to do it farmer by farmer and basically be able to take the milk. If I want to get sick, well, you know, I may eat a raw burger and I can get sick from that.
And the farmers would not be able to advertise this raw milk for sale.
Right. That's the idea. The idea is that this is sort of a non-advertisement, personal basis, and do it on a trial basis.
Now, in the past, when we've talked about raw milk, you've come down rather hard on this issue, saying not a good idea.
I have come down hard on the issue, but this particular issue, if you're doing it farmer by farmer, individual by individual, I think then it becomes another thing. And the more I thought about this, the more I thought about the fact that I happen to like steak tartare. Well, that runs a risk of E. coli. I happen to eat sushi. Well, that runs the risk of a whole variety of diseases of eating raw fish. If we have some way of regulating it and we don't taint the milk supply, then I think it becomes a different issue.
And it's a good idea to be able to kind of track who's buying this milk from where.
Oh, I think that is the bottom line issue. I think that if you do it on an individual basis so you can bring it back to the farm where you sold it, that's going to make the farmer more responsible, the consumer more responsible, and that will allow raw milk advocates to get what they want.
Interesting stuff, I think. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 800-462-7413, and at Oklahoma City, Oklahoma listener now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
You know, I have a very strange situation that I would love to get your input. And I hope you don't think I'm crazy, but a couple of years ago, I tried yoga. And I'm very athletic. I play tennis. I do a lot of different things. And yoga sounded like something that would help me with my balance. So I went to this actually wonderful class, wonderful teacher. And about halfway through the program, I started feeling ill, sick to my stomach. I thought it was the flu. You know, and that was all for about an hour I felt ill. And then it was gone. So the next week I did the same thing. And about halfway through the class I began to feel ill. And the third time it happened, the next week, I decided that it wasn't me, it was the yoga. Something was going on that literally made me feel ill. And I talked with the yoga teacher, and of course, you know, I think she knew as much as I did about this. And she came up with explanations all the way from you're releasing these toxins and you're, you know, releasing the evil from your life and you're this and that.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, that's clearly not from evil in your life.
It's
so does this happen every time you engage in yoga?
Well, this is why I'm actually curious about this. It was several years ago, and I tried it again last month. And about halfway through this yoga, it was a different teacher in a different class. It was still low-impact yoga, not a heavy-duty yoga class. And I felt ill in the middle of the class, had to sit down, open a window. That's the last I've tried it, but I just, it was such a strange phenomenon that I thought I would see if you'd have ever heard of that.
I've got the answer for you. What time?
I was going to say, here, this is a lay perspective. It sounds to me, and I have this, it sounds to me like it could be an inner ear thing and a balance problem when you're doing those slow motions for
yoga.
That's
exactly, it's a balance issue and it's a basovagal response.
Oh, I was right about that.
That's exactly what it is. Dr. Tom gave you the answer. It's a balance issue.
I've got that.
Yeah. It's a vasovagal response. It's benign positional vertigo. That's what it is. But it may not. You may not have the vertigo with it. And the reality is, don't do yoga. That's the answer. Don't do yoga. I know that I'll get calls from all the yoga people all over the world. Yoga is touchy-feely, but don't do it because there's certain activities you're doing that are producing the faint response. It's called vasovagal, V-A-S-O-V-A-G-A-L, and that's what you're doing when you're doing yoga. And for many people, it does over time depreciate. In other words, over time, if you do it, sometimes it goes away and it comes back, but it may be that way for the rest of your life. And it's just the way you're activating the parasympathetic nervous system in your body, and it's related to the activities. It's not the toxins in your body. It's not the evil spirits in your body. It's not the bad stuff that's going on in your body. It's a vasovagal response. It's just the way your body is responding. And my recommendation, high-impact stuff that gets your body moving, because that activates a different system. So you should jog. Good luck.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth. Today's myth deals with blood pressure and weightlifting. You always see people in the gym lifting heavy weights, and their bodies are tense, and you can't imagine that it's good for your blood pressure. But is it necessarily bad?
Well, the thought was that it was bad, but it turned out nobody did the studies, and now it's good. So it came from the fact that when you're lifting weights, you increase the intra-abdominal pressure, and you go, you're lifting heavy weights. Mm-hmm. And that does elevate your blood pressure. Major studies published in the Journal of Hypertension have now shown that weightlifting can lower blood pressure. Now, we're not talking about weightlifters who are young men and young women who are engaging in that Olympic sport, because their pressure goes up when they're actually lifting weights. So the bottom line is, it is a myth that you can't engage in weightlifting if you have blood pressure, but it is not a myth that you can't engage in heavy weightlifting when you have blood pressure. It should be moderate weightlifting to give your muscles tone, but I wouldn't try out for the Olympics.
Yeah, it's not a solid line between light or moderate heavy.
Well, the reality is super heavy. We're talking about where you have to grunt and you go, I can't get it up, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. And you're holding your breath for 5 or 10 seconds to try to push that weight up. You don't want that. But if you're pushing and you're blowing out your breath as you're lifting the weight, that's the key. If you're going, and you're blowing out your breath as you lift the weight, your pressure doesn't go up, it goes down.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, if you want us to lower your blood pressure by busting a myth for you, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Again, that number is 800-462-7413. And a caller now, Zorba in Wichita, Kansas. Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I was calling in because a couple of years ago, I was in a severe auto accident, head-on with a semi, and did a lot of damage to my legs. And one of the injuries was a compound fracture shattered my patella and tore my knee up pretty good. And I've had a lot of reconstructive surgery, and the surgeon told me that they had removed most of my cartilage, that there was no cartilage left in my knee, and I would have to have the whole joint replaced in about 10 years. And then when I was going to a doctor for a workers' compensation issue who examined my knee, he stated that I still had cartilage left in there. And he recommended that I start looking into cartilage regeneration therapy or procedures, which I had never heard of. And I've tried to do some research on it. I haven't been able to find a lot, so I'm wondering... My question would be about the success rate of those type of procedures and how a person would get involved in that type of treatment.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
It does not exist. Now, it does exist in an experimental model. In other words, there are a number of places around the country. If you basically, if you go to our website, we'll give you the link to clinicaltrials.gov, where you can look up clinical trials on pretty much anything. And what you want to do is look up a clinical trial if you decide you want to be experimented upon, which is okay, in regenerating cartilage. But at the present time, there is no method of regenerating cartilage. If we could do that, we wouldn't be doing total knees on lots of people. We would regenerate the cartilage for many people, because for many people, that's part of the issue.
Well, what do you think, Zorba, about how he had no cartilage and now he has cartilage?
Well, unless they looked in and looked at the bot, unless they went into the joint, looked at the entire joint and said, we don't see any cartilage, and then the same person looked in the joint and said, we have cartilage, there's no proof for that. In other words, you had an injury and you had a reconstruction, but you probably had some cartilage that was there. Now, did the person who say they saw the cartilage do a scope and find the cartilage?
No, he did not.
So
no,
you don't
scope,
know what's
no
there. You don't know what's there. In other words, it's smoke and mirrors. That's what we call it, smoke and mirrors. It's an imaging technique. It's not a real technique unless you look in there and you visually see it. So you may or may not have cartilage. And before that, you may or may not have had cartilage, but you don't regenerate cartilage right now, according to the best science.
Okay.
So, and the reason why you can't find much on it is there isn't much on it. It's all experimental procedure. But come to our website, zorbapastor.org. We'll give you the link to all clinical trials in the U.S., and then you can get some further information.
Okay. So. Well, yeah, I appreciate everything. It's been a big help.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. Before we get out of here, Zorba, we have another case for Judge Zorba. The defendant in this case is Rhonda from Green Bay, Wisconsin, with her husband as the prosecutor. She writes, I am a huge gardener. I use our local compost facility almost daily in the summer. I load up either a truckload or two or three of local ground mulch and or compost dirt. My husband is concerned about me inhaling mold spores causing respiratory and or lung problems. Is this something I should be concerned about? He suggested by wearing a mask at the compost facility, I would not feel like I was playing outdoors in nature with that on.
Oh, that certainly would be yucky, wouldn't it? Wear a mask when you're outside with nature. No, the mold spores are around, but they are benign. That's what they are. They are benign mold spores. A person who is healthy can handle it without a problem. Now, if you are on high-dose steroids, if you had HIV/AIDS, if you had other problems that would decrease your ability to fight disease, that would be a different problem. But for regular people, that is not a problem at all. Enjoy the compost and do not wear the mask. It would look silly.
Well, if you have a case you want Judge Zorba to rule on, send your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next week.
Hey, take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us day or night at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, the Matt Damon and Ben Affleck of Wisconsin Public Radio, put this hour together. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0424Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.